Welcome back. You're watching Stockwatch with me, Julietta Talevi. And joining me to take your stock-related questions this evening are Wayne McCurry from F&B Wealth and Investments and Dricus Combrink of Capicraft Investment Partners. If you'd like to send questions to us, please SMS 41392, email stockwatch@bdtv.co.za or tweet us at BusinessDayTV using the hashtag Stockwatch. Wayne, we have you there while we wait for Dricus. I have to say, you are full of investment wisdom today on your Twitter account. So I urge people who have Twitter accounts to go and follow what you had to say. But you did also talk about where we are at in the inflation cycle in the States, and we of course wait for the Fed to announce what it's going to do with interest rates shortly. Do you think they're going to pause, and do you think we've seen the worst?
I think it's 100% sure they're going to pause. I mean, if you examine that inflation number, the headline number, we all know that, but the month on month was maybe even more important. That was 0.1%. I mean, that is extremely low. And the real drivers of that inflation number are also very interesting. One is used cars, motor vehicles. But the one that I want to talk about is actually what's called owner equivalent rental, which is essentially the cost of owning a house. And that is determined primarily by interest rates, by long-term interest rates. Now, if you take long-term interest rates were a year ago and where they are now, you know, as the months progress, you're measuring off a higher base. And in fact, in a couple of months' time, you might be actually measuring off a higher base and a lower current value. So in other words, that owner's equivalent rental is going to plummet over the next 6 months or so, which should bring the inflation rate down more towards their target range. It's not going to where it was in the COVID years and the post-global financial crisis years, but it will go back into the range, I think, by the end of this year, beginning of next year. And I've been quite consistent in that view that inflation is going to fall back into acceptable levels, both here and globally by the end of this year. And all of this boils down to lower interest rates and interest rate cuts coming up end of this year, beginning of next year. And that's why the markets are going like crazy. That's why they is in anticipation of that. I think the inflation scare is over. And certainly in South Africa, I don't think we'll see another hike here because the US is pausing. But equally important, the Rand seems to have pulled back from the precipice. You know, it's trading, we last looked at about 1820, 1825. Now, that's still a cheap level, make no mistake. But it is certainly a vast improvement on 1970 going on 20, where it was literally a couple of trading days ago. So, I suppose it just shows you in investments how quickly things can swing from one extreme. And, you know, the market can change very, very rapidly. And we've seen the domestic shares. I mean, the bottom was sort of beginning of this month. And like my company's shares are from 59 Rand to 65 Rand. But Pick n Pay are up strongly. All of these SA domestic shares, after being sold off to truly bargain levels, have actually recovered quite nicely off that level, and they're still cheap at these levels despite the recovery that we see.
Yeah. Dricus, welcome. Thanks for joining us this evening. Would you concur with Wayne, firstly, about inflation in the States? And certainly there's a much better mood on the local markets. It helps when there isn't that much load shedding. The Rand is, as Wayne said, you know, back from the precipice. Do you think it's a sort of a false rally that's sucking us all in? Goodness knows we could do with a bit of good news. Or do you think actually we might be over the worst insofar as inflation is concerned in the States and locally that we might be heading into a slightly better economic situation?
No, sure. Basically, the backdrop is a cyclical slowdown in inflation. Growth, you know, hasn't come down. It's one of those rare cases where you jack up interest rates 500 basis points and you still have economic growth. The biggest reason for that is the big fiscal impulse in the US and all the secondary stimulus that's been created in the US beforehand. You had a lot of homeowners that locked in rates at 3%, mortgage rates at 3%. They aren't selling at this stage. Some of the research that I've seen says that's about a $700 to $800 billion injection, you know, that doesn't register as a monetary as QE or something, but nonetheless, you know, it's 700 to 800 billion less of interest payments over the next few years that consumers or mortgage holders will make in the US. So there's a lot of stuff happening at the moment or in the background that makes the US economy less interest rate sensitive. That's why we haven't seen implosion growth. Obviously, big savings as well, a big savings cushion. But one to know sooner or later rather than sooner in this case, you know, it does catch up with you. So if we don't get a drop in interest rates, then we will see, you know, later rather than sooner, a recession in the US. You can bank on that. The market, on the other hand, is banking that we'll see low inflation in the meantime. I can concur with that, low inflation. But it might be a little that we might be in the eye of the storm, a little positive cycle, inflation slowing down, growth looking fairly well, you know, but all this in the midst of big structural challenges, both locally and abroad. And if the economy, the world economy grows into next year, no recession in the US, no bigger recessions elsewhere, then we run into serious supply constraints again, and you will see inflation run up again.
Okay. Lots of big things to chew over. So let's look at specifics, and there's lots of stock-related questions this evening. So I shall launch straight into them. There was a question on DataTech. The CEO sold 9 million rands worth of stock in the last 2 days. Lessons from transaction capital say we must pay attention to what the jockey does. Any view on this one? Wayne, is this something that you would cause you a flutter?
Look, it is relevant information, but you never know the background to it. It might be tied into a debt maturity that was used to buy those shares. So it is relevant, but, you know, rather look at the fundamentals of the company and what the last earnings reports are and where it is in the industry, rather than just relying on directors selling or buying shares. But it is information you must take heed of, but I don't think that information by itself should force you to actually do a transaction.
Yeah, and I suppose unlike with Transaction Capital, where there had already been quite a strong pullback in the share price, DataTech's actually been rallying, and it was up again today. Drikus, what do you think? And if you were interested in DataTech as a company, I don't know if you look at them at all. Would you take this and say, okay, well, it's not such a bad move?
I think management has created a lot of value over the last few years from what can be perceived as quite a boring business. I think they unlocked quite a bit of value. We had a lot of special dividends, but they also, you know, made sure that they lined their own pockets, big remuneration package, and just selling a bit of that off, I suppose. They still left chunks of shares inside the director's share registers.
Okay, so you're a little bit jaundiced on that. Interestingly, we have a chart that's about, 24 years. It shows the dot-com crash and DataTech at 140 Rand, and it's never recovered to those levels at 40 bucks a share. Okay, but I'll move on. Talking about U.S. markets, and DataTech is particularly exposed to the U.S., there's a question on Renogen asking what had happened to its share price once it lists on NASDAQ. Wayne, I suppose it's almost a given. I mean, they're looking for this, but nothing firm has been announced yet. Would you anticipate it to rally, or is that also not a given?
No, that's not a given. Just listing on the NASDAQ or listing on an overseas share market or changing your classification doesn't change the underlying company. Ultimately, share prices are only driven by prospects, by cash flows, by dividend flows, by profits. Changing the listing or taking it somewhere else may help a bit in the shorter term. If the company performs, the share price will go up no matter where it's listed. If the company doesn't perform, the share price will go down no matter where it's listed.
Drikus, your thoughts on Renogen and its NASDAQ aspirations?
Yeah, what complicates the whole Renogen valuation is obviously the fact that they would need to issue new stock as part of the listing, so IPO. On the NASDAQ, and they would need to list new stock. At which price? How dilutive is that going to be? We still don't really know. And that kind of determines what the value is at the moment. If it's too dilutive, you might be overpaying here. But I do think there's solid margin of safety. And I think it would have been better if a large player like Ivanhoe last year, which stepped away, came in, an industry player, and just said, listen, we're going to back you guys and we're going to underwrite the share price. But this is not what's happening at the moment. You've got financial institutions, backing them, and they're not really underwriting the share price.
Are you talking specifically to the loans that were recently announced, Standard
Yes.
Bank being one of them?
Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes.
All right, so you would want to see some sort of big buyer with,
A strategic holding, yes. Some strategic shareholder.
Yeah, okay. Sticking with kind of the thorny question of listings and jurisdictions, a viewer says, please be so kind as to ask the panel, is it better for a South African investor to buy the South African Limited or UK PLC shares of Investec and 91 on the JSE? Wayne, I always get confused. I never know. Well, hopefully you can illuminate us what the answer is to this.
I think the profits and the shares are actually linked. So to be honest, I don't know the answer to that. As far as I know, and I could be totally wrong, it is effectively the same share. It just depends on what register you're on. But I honestly don't know. I always thought they were like the De Beers, Anglo American, and many other companies that had these dual listings, but the shares were linked and there were agreements between the companies that they'll always show the same profits and have the same balance sheet, etc.
Okay.
It's exactly the same. The only difference being, which one do you buy? It depends on where you're taxpayer. It's more tax efficient dividend wise to buy it in the UK if you're a UK investor. If you're a South African investor, you buy it here. It's just more tax efficient. Going to pay less dividend tax. So on the margin, better to buy it in your tax jurisdiction.
So that would, in other words, be the limited for Investec and 91 if you're a South African investor?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for clearing that up for us. There is a question on multi-choice, which came out with an update recently. And the question is multi-choice or no choice? Does the panel have a view on multi-choice at these levels? What I'm really wondering is if there is a realistic medium to long-term probability of Vivendi, the French group, making a minority offer since Canal Plus were happy to hoover up every share they could get between 120 Rand and 135 Rand. Drikus, perhaps you can shed some light.
Yeah, I've been following some streaming companies offshore as well, looking to buy into them. And the problem is if you're late to the game, some of the early movers are doing quite well, but it costs a lot to create content. It costs a lot to move your clients. You cannibalize your own business to a large degree if you were a cable or satellite type company like MultiChoice were. Luckily, they've got a lot of content that they can stream to the rest of Africa. And I do think that's worth something. I think their super sport contracts and their sporting broadcasting rights is worth something. Whether they can sufficiently monetize that and switch that from dish to streaming, I think it's a big, big question mark. But they've been saying for 2 years now that the African business is going to turn profitable any period. We're still waiting. I'm not sure. I'm on the sidelines here.
Wayne, your thoughts? Would you assume because someone came in and bought up a stake in a company at a higher price, therefore, that is the price to which it should return if the share is trading below the price?
No, that's what price people paid for a share in the past is not actually all that relevant. It's what the prospects of the company are. Now, in South Africa, they've gone X growth. They're getting less per user now as people downscale from premium as the Netflix and the YouTubes take up more of your viewing time. I certainly know at our house we watch significantly less DSTV than what we did 2 years ago, significantly less.
Yeah.
The African content is a prize asset if they can monetize it properly. But as they said, and as many other players have experienced, it's tough doing business in the rest of Africa. Things jump out at you there that you never expected. But the local content, certainly the African local content, is something that the big streaming companies worldwide just aren't doing. So they've got this niche. And essentially all of their growth comes from that part of business. But it's expensive to start off. It's expensive to create content. And, they cut their dividend to zero, if I remember correctly. And to be honest, it's not a business I would buy. It's not a share I would buy.
Yeah, the cut of the dividend, Drikas, I mean, did that kind of set off alarm bells, or do you think, okay, it's perfectly within a company's rights. If they say they need the cash, they've got to keep it, they want to invest in the business, maybe that's a better option for their money than to pay out a dividend to shareholders.
No, sure. So what I was actually trying to allude to, looking at the US businesses, aside from Netflix or one or two of the others, most of those going into streaming are doing that with quite a big cash flow balance sheet on, you know, next to it, with the legacy business. And it takes quite a while that, you know, before you generate some returns on the new streaming business. You need a lot more scale because it's a lower pricing point, et cetera, for the same amount of content. So the market is saying, yeah, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. It's an unproven business model for most. It's Africa, you know, how much uptake are you going to have? You know, you haven't got fiber all over the continent. It's not as easy. So it's going to take time. There will be a return on capital, but it's going to take time. So what's your ROI going to be? I think that's why the share price has fallen in the last few weeks.
Yeah. Okay. Then moving on, there's a question, another sort of technical question on the tax treatment of property ETFs. So the question is, does a property ETF pay a distribution which is subject to tax like a REIT or a dividend that is tax-free? Well, the dividend would have been taxed already in the hands of the company, yes? Wayne, do you know?
Look, I'm not an expert on the ETF and the tax. What I do know is the REITs have a special compensation where you actually don't pay tax on your profits as long as you distribute them. I mean, there is still some tax. It's all actually quite technical. But essentially, if you own a property REIT and you get your 6-monthly distribution, it is taxable in your hands. Now, unless there's some way the ETF washes that, which I don't think so, you know, and once again, stress, I'm not an expert here at all, but I would think if you own an ETF, it's like owning a basket of REITs, and you will get taxed on the distribution. But go find out from a tax expert. Mm. It's quite a complicated thing, this.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, ETFs fall under the Collective Investment Schemes Control Act, CISCA. So, you know, it's the same as a unit trust. In a unit trust, annually, you know, they give you supporting documents saying this was the income received, this is the dividends received. You give that to your, you know, you fill that into your
tax
receipt or your tax. We'll give it to your tax advisor, and that's it. So, yeah, you're actually still taxed as an income. It will still be registered as an income, even though you're buying the ETF.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Then there's a question on U.S. bank ETFs. Is there a U.S. bank ETF worth investing in, or should one just invest in individual bank stocks? Wayne, what would be your preference, particularly if it's the U.S. market?
Look, I don't think there's anything wrong with buying some sort of index tracker or the ETF. I'm sure in the U.S. market there is a bank ETF somewhere there, but I don't know of any. U.S. banks, you know, they look cheap enough, but, you know, a lot of them have been caught with this rising interest rate, with not the correct interest hedges in place. You know, they just didn't really anticipate it. So even though the shares look cheap, I think there's a bit more trouble coming in that sector because these guys didn't hedge their book. Mm. And they've got liabilities that all of a sudden they've got an interest rate that they didn't anticipate. And we've seen the squeeze there. A good couple of them have been, you know, properly squeezed. And I think there's maybe even a little bit more to come. Because even though I'm positive on interest rates falling, they're not going back to the levels where the banks took on a lot of those liabilities at, you know, below 1% on the long bond. And now they've, you know, so maybe it settles at 3%. Maybe it settles at 2.5%. That's still a long way from 1%.
Yeah. Drikas, would you also be quite wary of U.S. banks at this juncture?
Yeah, it depends on on your view of interest rates, like we've just said. And yeah, the danger is always that interest rates surprises to the upside, and not interest rates. Sorry, the long bond yield, because they keep the long bond on the assets or on the balance sheet as assets, as collateral, as a tier one asset, And that was part of the regional banking crisis we just saw, you know, with Silicon Valley Bank, et cetera, getting into trouble, is that that part of your balance sheet, all of a sudden, when rates go from 1 to 4, you know, the 10-year and the 20-year, et cetera, you lose a lot of capital, and all of a sudden you are technically insolvent, as some of those banks were. The problem is if it goes, I think it's 3.8% at the moment, the 10-year. If the 10-year goes from 3.8 to 5.5%, 6%, in what case can that happen? In which scenario? Well, the Treasury General Account needs to be refilled. About $1 trillion will be issued before the end of the year, just to refill a part. Part of that will be to refill the Treasury General Account. And the other part will be to obviously just supply the deficit. The deficit is enormous. So the supply of treasuries coming into the market is enormous.
Okay.
And there is a smallish chance, but big enough to take note that, you know, the bond market might surprise you in a bad way.
Okay. And also commercial real estate, that seems to be a bit of a problem. And, you know, if you've got exposure to commercial real estate in the States, once again, because of high interest rates, this is something that, you know, seems to be cropping up in reports.
Yeah, look at what has just happened in San Francisco and Los Angeles. A few buildings have been just left. No, so a lot of REITs and companies in the U.S., they only attach the debt to the specific property. So they can default on a specific property without that even touching the credit rating of the
of the overall company. Okay. Drickers, we lost you.
Yeah.
We lost you there for a second.
Box and Hotels just dropped a 500 million property in San Francisco.
Okay. So be cautious. And a quick question before I get to your stock picks. A viewer says, can you ask your panelists about the investment case for Anglo American, BHP, and Glencore? Is it prudent to hold all of them? And why? I mean, Wayne, you always say diversification is the only free lunch. Would you hold three different, fairly diversified, big resources companies, or is that maybe too much?
Maybe a bit too much. Look, I mean, and I know I'm probably wrong in saying this, but, you know, as a participant in the market for so long, we get a little bit worried, tainted, concerned about Glencore. You know, even though they swear the past is behind them, you never know what could still come up. But the other two companies, yes, I would own, because I'm actually quite bullish on the medium-term outlook for mining resource companies.
Yeah. Drickers, very quickly, because I'm not leaving you much time for stock picks.
I don't like iron ore, so I'm not buying BHP or Anglo's. I like copper, I like gold, I like ag commodities, so I'll buy Glencore.
Okay, a contrary view. Well, maybe have a Glencore and a BHP in that case. Okay, I'll get your stock picks. Drickers, staying with you, what would you be picking this evening?
Yeah, even more controversial. It's a company called Natural Resource Partners. It's listed in New York. It's a limited partnership, so you must check. There's some certain tax rules around that, but there's a way to get around that. Natural Resource Partners is sitting in low or high single-digit price-earnings ratio. They've got a lot of coal royalty assets. So royalty assets are actually quite valued a lot. There's no overheads. They don't take the risk of mining the stuff themselves. They only sell the royalties. And they're also invested in maybe the second biggest soda ash producer in the world, Sisecam Resources. They recently, I think they're still listed apart. They're still listed, Sisecam Resources. They mine soda ash, and soda ash is a very common chemical, but it's only found in a few places where it's concentrated and economic enough to mine. That's a valuable asset for them. Sitting low digit price earnings ratios, they're paying off their debt. That should be finished within the next 2 years. And then you might see dividend yields of double digits. For royalty assets. Royalty assets have low single-digit dividend yields.
Okay, well, a very interesting one to go and do a bit of research on. Thank you, Drickers, for that suggestion. Wayne, how about you?
Yeah, I'm going for Zeta, the one with four digits, not the one with five digits. So it was the car hire company. When you look at their maintenance 6 months results and you make the assumption that they'll repeat that over the next 6 months, This company is at extremely low valuation levels. I'm also very positive about inbound tourism and even domestic tourism and the effect it will have on car hire going forward. So this just looks extremely cheap at these levels for, you know, quite a nice business. And it's not just car hire, you know, they've got the leasing business and all of those things. So I think, yeah, why not? It looks really, really lowly valued.
Okay, well, we shall leave it there. Wayne Drickus, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Nice to chat to you both. Wayne McCurry is from F&B Wealth and Investments. Drickus Combrink is of Capricraft Investment Partners.